Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. It's a brave new world, and at the heart of it is everything digital and wireless. Who wouldn't want to be wireless and free to roam anywhere with the internet at your fingertips and with devices that weigh hardly anything? As it turns out, things that are too good to be true really are too good to be true, or at least have negative consequences. When it comes to all things wireless, besides the enormous and pervasive invasion of personal privacy, this form of radiation is having the same health effects as ionizing radiation. Otherwise known as X-ray and nuclear, this is the other revolutionary breakthrough that was supposed to save the world. If we're paying attention, post-Fukushima, we are seeing environmental and health destruction at a level not even imagined before, and the results are just now being known. The effect will continue for, well, ever. So, as we enter this new brave world of technology meant to save the world, let's pause to look carefully at what the unintended consequences might be, and in fact already are. Stay tuned as we consider the health considerations for the digital revolution. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The Wildlife Conservation Society has launched an international effort to prevent the extinction of a dozen turtle species. Turtles. I marvel at this. People from around the world collaborating to save creatures because it's the right thing to do. The marvel is that human beings are capable of selflessness, empathy, doing the right thing. We need more of those marvels. Of course, the Wildlife Conservation Society is not unique in this regard, yet another marvel. It is also not unique in getting itself into moral dilemmas. Last year, the head of the organization in India was forced to resign because he participated in implementation of the Forest Rights Act, environmental legislation common to many developing countries where the traditional rights of tribal people to land are restored. International organizations such as the Wildlife Conservation Society oppose these laws because they believe that tribal peoples will not properly manage wild places. The dilemma was protect the wildlife or protect the tribal people. Some argued that it was a false dilemma, that in fact protecting tribal rights would also protect wildlife. However, although almost all moral dilemmas have questions of fact at their core, I want to bring to your attention how humans actually work out what to do, in particular the critical role of the context in which moral dilemmas arise and are resolved. In the last decade or so, both psychologists and neuroscientists have uncovered what goes on in our brain when we make moral decisions. A typical experiment consists of posing a moral dilemma to someone and identifying what areas of the brain light up when he or she decides what to do. A classic moral dilemma used in these experiments is called the trolley problem. A runaway trolley is headed toward a switch that you control. Along one track, five people are working. Along another, one person is working. You can't stop the train, but only change which track the trolley runs along. If you throw the switch, the trolley kills the single worker, saving the other five. Do you throw the switch? 9 out of 10 people throw the switch. The brain area that lights up is used for calculation. Essentially, those who throw the switch are making a utilitarian decision, one life for five. But if the dilemma is changed, a different area of the brain lights up. This dilemma, again a classic, is called the man on the bridge problem. The trolley is coming, there are five workers on the track, but instead of standing at a switch, you're standing on a bridge over the track. Next to you is a large man who, if thrown in front of the trolley, would bring it to a stop before hitting the five workers. Do you throw the large man in front of the trolley? This time, 9 out of 10 people would not throw the man in front of the train, sacrificing the five to save the one. The brain area that lights up is used not for calculation, but for emotion and empathy. Those who chose to throw the switch justified their action with utilitarian reasoning, greatest good to the greatest number. Those who chose not to throw the large man from the bridge appealed to their gut feeling, their intuition. It just didn't feel right. Researchers frequently use this contrast to suggest that the intuitionists have made a moral choice of poor quality. In other words, the utilitarian credo of greatest good to the greatest number defines good moral choices. That bias is understandable. As Marx observed, utilitarianism is the philosophy of the market, which saturates the air we breathe. It also turns out to have some unsavory associations. The people whose brains light up in resolving moral dilemmas with a utilitarian calculation are those prone to analytic thinking, such as philosophers and scientists, and men, and people who score high for antisocial characteristics on tests for psychopathology and Machiavellianism. But that information doesn't answer the question of whether it's right to throw the switch or the large man. Of course, it would be hard to suggest that it's wrong to throw the switch at all. Or would it? What if the worker who gets killed is your child? Faced with that kind of dilemma, the split is half and half, not 9 out of 10 who would throw the switch. So context is critical, and so is your emotional distance from the subjects of your actions. Consider the following dilemma. A scientific panel has decided that Teflon causes testicular and kidney cancer. You are an executive at DuPont responsible for Teflon. Do you stop producing Teflon, throwing hundreds of people out of work? Or consider this dilemma. You are a public official. Before you is an application for construction of a cell tower. Most people want the better cell phone reception that is promised. A small number of people fear for their health and the health of their children. Do you vote for or against the application? The moral dilemma is not just about the possible outcomes. It is also about how you create the context in which the dilemma is resolved and how you feel about the people who are affected. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our topic for the day, health considerations for the digital revolution, and our guest, B. Blake Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T. B. Blake Levitt is an award-winning journalist who has specialized in medical and science writing for over 2 decades. She's researched the biological effects of non-ionizing radiation since the late 1970s. A former New York Times freelance contributor, she's written widely on medical issues for both the lay and professional audience. Her work has appeared in numerous national publications and has been translated into Russian and Chinese. She's the editor contributing author of Cell Towers, Wireless Convenience or Environmental Hazard, Proceedings of the Cell Towers Forum, State of the Science, State of the Law, and she's author of Electromagnetic Fields, A Consumer's Guide to the Issues and How to Protect Ourselves. Ms. Levitt's work is referenced in numerous government publications and other resources on EMF. She's helped congressional offices write legislation for energy research appropriations and land use issues pertaining to antenna and cell siting. She's also participated in congressional briefings on the environmental effects of ambient energy exposures, and she was an invited speaker at the Royal College of Physicians in London on the environmental effects of non-ionizing radiation. Ms. Levitt lectures widely on the subject of environmental energy and consults for municipalities and who are considering telecommunications regulations. Blake Levitt, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Lena.
You wild thing, you.
I know.
I
just wanted to say I like Jeffrey's editorial, and
yes.
it's a very apt analogy regarding what this technology has done in the dynamic tension between the people who want the service and the people who are forced to live near the infrastructure.
Exactly.
It's a question of throwing entire neighborhoods under the bus in order to accomplish that. So it was a very apt analogy, Jeffrey.
Well, and it's also true, we'll talk about this as the show goes on, but it's also true that when public officials are faced with people instead of just letters from people, but they actually see people who are injured talking about how they feel, it isn't perfect, but it has, I think, a stronger effect than just getting letters saying.
Or when they become injured themselves.
That too, yes. So in case anyone's still confused, what's different and the same about ionizing and non-ionizing radiation?
Oh, is that for me?
Yes, it is.
What's different and what's the same?
Yes.
Oh, well, the actual physics haven't changed for the most part, but our understanding of the consequences of what we're doing with so many increasing layers of technology now, that's beginning to change.
No. What I'm asking is, we have two different forms of radiation. People are used to thinking radiation means X-ray, nuclear fission products, that sort of thing. And now we have this thing that's called non-ionizing radiation, and we're discovering that the actual effects are very similar in terms of health effects. The mechanisms are different, but it's very similar. But the actual technology, the actual thing is slightly different, and so I thought you might want to start by explaining the differences between the two.
Oh, okay. I would be happy to do that. From a classic a definition model, from a physics perspective and from a biology perspective, the electromagnetic spectrum is divided into the categories of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. Ionizing radiation is everything thought to be around the visible light spectrum, all the way up through nuclear activity, cosmic events, things in the much higher frequency range. Non-ionizing radiation is everything from the visible light spectrum all the way down to the Earth's natural electromagnetic fields. Most people don't realize that the electromagnetic spectrum and electromagnetic energy is very much a natural part of the universe. The Earth, for instance, is a giant dipole magnet that emanates 10 hertz frequencies from the core, from the Earth's core, in a constant electromagnetic field that changes slightly depending on where you are on the Earth. And also, interestingly enough, the human anatomy, conscious thought, also functions in the 10 hertz frequency range. We are fantastically sensitive to natural electromagnetic fields. Now, in terms of how we have classically defined the difference biologically between the biological effects between those two, it's been known for a very long time that that ionizing radiation, like X-rays, have enough inherent power to knock electrons off of cellular orbits and thereby cause things like genetic mutations, which can lead to cancer. It was thought for the last, maybe 50 years or so, possibly longer than that, that the only real biological effects from the non-ionizing bands, which encompasses all of our telecommunications technology, all radio, TV transmission, Wi-Fi, anything wireless, and also includes all of the extremely low frequencies that are used in power line transmission. It was thought that the only biological effects, the acute biological effects, were from electrocution, you know, like getting a shock from putting your finger in an electric socket, if you were silly enough to do that, or from tissue heating, the way a microwave oven cooks food, and that would occur in the radio frequencies. And so those were the two things that we have traditionally created standards against those kinds of exposures to people. However, within the last 20 to 25 years, actually from the entire genesis of the dialogue having to do with the radio frequencies in particular, there have been people who have challenged that notion of thermal effects only being the thing that we needed to regulate for. There is now a whole range of studies that's come out over the last 20 years, but very much accelerated within the past 10 years, that have found very serious non-thermal effects in the population at standards that are far below that standard tissue heating model. And this knowledge is coming about at a point in time in which we are continuing to give the benefit of the doubt to the industry, to various wireless industries, and we are surrounding ourselves with increasing layers of exposure from everything from cordless deck phones in people's homes to Wi-Fi computer systems in schools to the infrastructure needed to support mobile cell phone technology.
Well, and, of course, smart meters, too.
Oh, and smart meters. Oh, yes, smart meters.
So one of the things, let me just very quickly say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with B. Blake Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T. She is a science and medical journalist, and she's been covering the issue that we're discussing today, which is health considerations for a digital revolution, for well over 20 years. the thing that confounds people and confuses people is this very thing that you were talking about, which is that we are electric ourselves, and that we, you know, there's a discussion now about the fact that we like birds that migrate and other animals that migrate, we also have magnetite in our brains, which orients us toward the magnetic field of the Earth. What is confusing is that it's hard for people to understand how such low-level exposures, you know, that are hard to even pick up on a meter, can be causing such extraordinary health effects. And we have this new paper, well, it's not that new, but this paper that was fairly recently published in the Environmentalist magazine by Cindy Sage, where she goes in and looks at the ionizing radiation and its effects as it comes over from Fukushima and what we already know, and the non-ionizing or wireless radiation, and points out in this paper, among other things, the main purpose of the paper is to point out that the actual health effects are remarkably the same, although the mechanisms may be slightly different. They cause the same problem, and one of them is that this damage to the DNA at very low levels. And in fact, what she points out is that the low exposure levels are worse for causing illness.
Yeah, that's actually something that has been observed in the bioelectromagnetics literature going back for at least 50 years. It's called a nonlinear effect. Most of our standards, for instance, are set on what are called linear models, which means that, you know, a certain amount of a toxin, say trichloroethylene, will cause effects as you get more of it. Will cause more adverse effects as you get higher exposures. Nonlinear effects refer to a phenomenon in which you get more extreme effects at lower intensity exposures. And a classic nonlinear effect, for instance, would be an allergic reaction. How is it that somebody can be thrown into anaphylactic shock from being in the same room as a peanut if they have a peanut allergy? That's a classic nonlinear effect to an individual's immune system. Well, it turns out that because we are coherent electrical systems, as opposed to chemical mechanistic systems, because we're coherent electrical systems, there's a high likelihood that we are actually more sensitive to external electromagnetic fields that are much more similar to what we are naturally at a biological level. I usually describe it as living cells will take direction from very low-level electromagnetic fields as a form of wiggy self that external electromagnetic fields can very randomly direct cells to change their metabolic rates. They can alter calcium intake. They can cause cells to dump calcium, which can change metabolism. They can do any number of things. They also, it's not just calcium. They work on ion, what are called the potassium ion channels in the skin. They can also, at the surface skin level, transmit information that is unintentional to deep interiors of the body. And so what is now being finally talked about, and Cindy did an excellent job in this paper of hers, was to essentially show that we are in harmony either with ionizing radiation as well as with both forms of radiation. And it's beginning to look like, from the research that's emerging, it's beginning to look like that entire construct was an artificial construct, mostly set up so that physicists and engineers could get a handle on it and parse this exposure from that exposure to allow this technology versus that technology. And so we're coming to a very different understanding of that now. It's one of the things that Henry Lai and I discussed in a paper that we wrote in Environmental Reviews that came out last year, having to do with very, very low intensity exposures from RF infrastructure. And we covered everything from broadcast radiation all the way through cell infrastructure and many other kinds of infrastructure there as well. And one of the things that we did, the focus of our paper was on the very, very low intensity effects that were present in the literature far below standards, really at the point almost of cellular electric current. And we came across something like between 50 and 70 studies that were positive for biological effects. And the upshot of that is that there's really no way for anyone to take a look at the body of this literature and say that these low-level exposures are not biologically active. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're all adverse, but unless we pay tribute to the fact that we are fantastically sensitive to these, and not just us, other species as well, we're never going to be able to get a handle on, for instance, the difference, and this is where we should be paying attention, the difference between therapeutic applications for low-level exposures versus adverse effects. What we have now environmentally with this sort of wireless juggernaut that we have going on is not only an uncontrolled global experiment, but we're just kind of letting it rip with our fingers crossed. And there is, like I said, there's a tremendous body of research for us to take a look at that warrants far more caution than anything that we're bringing to the table right now, certainly in America.
Yeah, let me just unpack a couple of things. First of all, you used a scientific term that I don't think our listeners are used to hearing, Wiggy self, which I think you mean by that the body can't really tell with these low exposures whether or not it is in fact a wigged out or insane version of themselves, and it readjusts itself around. So in these cases, what you see are symptoms with people who are being exposed to a lot of wireless from smart meters and as you say, cell tower infrastructure and smart meter infrastructure, their neighbors' wireless, their own wireless, whatever, where they become very nervous, they become hyper-aroused, they're not sleeping, their heart is pounding, their blood pressure's up. Sometimes people are having seizures and nosebleeds, so they're having very extreme hyper-aroused stress responses.
Including skin rashes.
Yes.
Changes in mast cells in skin that react to very, very low intensity exposures. And just a host of things, decreased libido, depression, increases in suicide. And people very often don't understand what it is that they're reacting to. Many of their doctors don't have the vaguest idea what they're reacting to. They're just sort of presenting in doctor's offices as being highly symptomatic from something that is undetermined.
And indeed, you know, when people contact me to talk to me about their health, what I'm seeing is that they are describing symptoms that are electromagnetic sensitivity symptoms, electrosensitive symptoms, and they don't realize it. They don't know why they're having it. There's also, in my observation, anecdotally, suddenly a marked increase in the number of people being diagnosed with obscure autoimmune diseases. I'm hearing from people with, and I heard from two people in 2 weeks, with a diagnosis of antiphospholipid antibody. Well, this is when your body's attacking your phospholipids, which are in your brain and your lung surfactant. They're made of cholesterol. I could not figure out, but it causes clotting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also been contacted by several people who have been diagnosed with scleroderma, which is a very, very serious autoimmune disease. And upon examination of their labs and all the rest of it, it's not clear that they have scleroderma, but their body is reacting as if they did. So the research you're referring to is Ole Johansson putting people in an environment where they're exposed to stuff, and whether they reported symptoms or not, their mast cells that produce histamine in their skin that are responsible for an allergic response were all granulated and hyperactivated.
Mm-hmm.
So from Cindy's paper, what she's saying is that both of these forms of radiation, non-ionizing and ionizing, can result at low levels in increased risk of cancers, allergic and inflammatory responses, depressed immune function, loss of adaptive response to infectious diseases and tumors, so cancer and not the body not being able to respond, and allergic sensitivity, all of which there's also the oxidative damage. So lots of free radicals and things like that being produced. And this isn't both things. The other thing I wanted to just very quickly say is that when you referred to Henry Lai, that he is the last researcher standing in the United States. Dr. Henry Lai he's funded by the cancer the industry, to study the effects of electromagnetic fields pulsed onto tumor cells to see if it works for cancer. So he's been able to continue his research with this, but he's actually been coming out a little more, saying things that are disturbing. And lastly, what I wanted to say is there are researchers that were doing research for the military in the 60s and even earlier.
Oh, yeah.
And some groups that are concerned about all of this, that are looking into, some activists have contacted some of these guys, and they're fairly elderly now, and their research is not digitized; it's in boxes. But there are boxes and boxes and boxes of research from that period that were done for the military that were not released anywhere into the public, you know, domain, that show harm. And in fact, the military, as people have said me say on the show before, has famously studied the effects of bombarding people with these fields to incapacitate them as a non-lethal weapon. And the symptoms that they found are exactly the symptoms that electrosensitives are complaining to the feds and to the PUCs of their areas from the smart meters.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that Dr. Lai and I also covered in our paper for Environmental Reviews. We did a complete literature review going back to the early several of the early studies, and we brought all of the contemporary research back around to the research that was brought out of Russia when the American embassy was systematically irradiated with microwaves by the Russians for a number of years, and we had an almost perfect match between what those exposures were determined to be and what an exposure within a 1,500 foot radius from a cell tower is, and the symptoms matched almost perfectly with the exposures too. One of the other things that I wanted to say, though, partly in response to your asking what's the same and what's different, one of the things that's really different is that in the last 10 years, we very much have changed the signaling characteristics that are being used now. There didn't used to be such a thing as a phased array. Phased array is a time sequence pulse that has the ability to come at living tissue from many different directions simultaneously. And that can be very, very confusing to cells and to whole living organisms. We're increasingly using phased array. We did not used to have a digital pulse signaling. That's very different. None of these things exist in nature. So not only are we increasing the background levels, we're very much changing the signaling characteristics of the technologies that we're infusing the environment with.
And so one thing we might say here is that part of the reason that these fields may be native to us in some way, because we get radiation from the sun, even we get radiation from, we get magnetic fields from the ground, is not just because of the amount
or the
way that they're changed. The particular fields may be slightly altered from what we're used to, but it's also the way they're delivered, and that's what you just said,
which is exactly right.
Yeah, so it's the pulsing of them or the other things of them.
Well, and we also don't have without the 20th century, we would not have these intensities at the Earth's surface for any of these frequencies. In its natural state, the world would have very little in the way of radio frequency and microwave radiation arriving at the Earth's surface from the Earth. So we've changed the signaling characteristics to nothing that exists in nature. We've also altered the power density levels in these frequency concentrations at the Earth's level, and we're doing it in a way that without understanding the full biological implications. But yes, the research does go back easily to the 1950s. The first researcher was a man named John T. McLaughlin. He was the medical director for Hughes Aircraft in 1957. He was the first to notice cataracts, fertility problems, malaise, increased flu symptoms in radar workers who worked for Hughes Aircraft, and that set off a series of research efforts that were primarily directed by the military through the 1950s and 60s that generated quite a bit of information, a lot of which is still around.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the researchers are still alive too. They're a kind of a national treasure at the moment in terms of being able to help us understand what it is that we're doing. And most of them have been trying to alert us to problems with this for any length of time.
Yes.
You know, people like Abe Liboff and Alan Fry and
Sam Milhelm.
And Sam Milhelm. Mm-hmm. Many of those we've lost really seminal researchers like Ross Ady and Robert Becker, but we still very much have their work.
Yeah. We need to take a very brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett is standing by, and we are on the phone with the initial B, Blake Levitt. She is a award-winning journalist, science writer, has been covering the issues that we're discussing, which is the health considerations for the digital revolution, for over 20 years. We're going to just break briefly with a bit of music, and we'll come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archive shows. Choose a download or our new library card feature. There's information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Contact us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Blake, did you want to give out any contact?
People can reach me through my website, www.blakelevitt.com. Excuse me.
Did that
come through?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well done.
Okay. Oh, one of the other things that I wanted to say that's different is that we now have some pretty impressive august bodies stepping up to the plate and trying to warn people. We've always had that, but it's always been sort of off to the side. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine just released a report that in particular is calling for caution when it comes to smart grid technologies.
Yeah, let me just explain who they are. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine on their site says they were founded in 1965, and they are an international association of physicians and other professionals interested in the clinical aspects of humans and their environment. So this was a position paper that came out recently, and it's quite strong in its statements.
Should I read the bullet points for what they're asking for?
Whatever you'd like to do, yeah. If you want to highlight it, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things they're asking for is an immediate caution on smart meter installation due to potentially harmful RF exposure. They're asking for accommodation for health considerations regarding EMF and RF exposure, including exposure to wireless smart meter technology. They're calling for independent studies to further understand the health effects of EMF and RF exposure, recognition that electromagnetic hypersensitivity is a growing problem worldwide. We can talk about that a little bit later, Lena, if you want to. Understanding the control of this electrical environment bombardment for the protection of society. They're calling for consideration and independent research regarding the quantum effects of EMF and RF on human health, and they're asking for the use of safer technology, including for smart meters such as hard wiring, fiber optics, or other non-harmful methods of data transmission.
Yeah, now the paper that they produced is a rather large document, and it does go over an enormous number of issues specific to the health effects, some of which we've discussed, many of which we've discussed, and it's quite damning actually, and it's impressive. I mean, it's another one of these things that's come out in recent history that should have just stopped. Everything should have just stopped when that came out.
That's what's interesting about this is that these reports do come out, and there are many of them now, many from Europe, several from America, and nothing does stop. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I was impressed with was another substantial report that came out from the Environment and Human Health Inc. in North Haven, in Connecticut, that was put out by probably about six or seven people on the faculty at Yale, none of whom are particularly known to have expertise in this area, but all come from different disciplines within the Yale medical community. And they got in there and they rumbled around with the subject, and you can see what they came up with, which was quite impressive. calling for caution in particular with the use of cell phones and children. There's another August group that came out with something. And now when it comes to smart meter technologies, we've got any number of government agencies that are trying to warn populations and warn legislators that we've got a problem with this. Even the Department of Energy itself, which is the lead agency for the smart grid build-out, their agency watchdog, their inspector general, whose name is Gregory H. Friedman, issued a scathing report that was talking about the shortcomings in cybersecurity plans of more than a third of the utility companies that have already gotten funding for the smart grid. And he's pointing to initial weaknesses that that had not been fully addressed, that they were aware of. They're talking about completely unacceptable levels of risk having to do with cybersecurity and calling for mitigation strategies to offset threats and weaknesses that may go completely unidentified until there are massive problems with the national utility grid. So that's another thing, and that's from the DOE itself. The Congressional Research Service put out a legal document that's also very impressive that is essentially examining the implications of the privacy issue when it comes to the smart grid. It turns out that the smart grid, as currently designed, and that's the operative word, as currently designed, has the ability to, it's a two-way communication system, but it has the ability to allow the government to really understand exactly who you are and what you're up to at any given point in time. It's a tremendous invasion of privacy, and it's one of the things that has gotten the attention of the Tea Party, who are all for individual rights. But this particular document by the Congressional Research Service is comparing the possibility of constitutional issues having to do with Fourth Amendment violations, having to do with probable cause for search and seizure in an area in which a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Smart grid technologies will be able to provide utility companies and the government and the local police not only with the general knowledge of when you're home and when you aren't, but with very specific, what's called granular knowledge. That's not my term. That's the term of an activist up in Vermont, a very granular knowledge of exactly what appliances you own and exactly how you use them, which is a whole other level of government intrusion and curiosity. So this was a very damning legal document, essentially trying to warn the Congress about constitutional issues from the entire way that the system is designed. A very interesting report has come out from the Government Accountability Office, having to do with challenges in securing the modernized electricity grid. And they're also talking about oversight. They're talking about security issues, privacy issues, constitutional issues. So finally, people are really beginning to get their teeth into things. The sort of intellectual core in Washington, D.C. is taking a look at things and saying, holy smokes, what are we doing here?
Yeah, not fast enough. But
not fast enough, and as a matter of fact, the CIA has also warned that the smart grid as currently designed cannot be made cyber secure.
Oh, there's so many people saying that. The other thing that's ironic here is that people who have rejected and opted out, because here in California, there is now a program for people to refuse using smart meters. They are planning on charging something for it, although I might mention to people that as of this broadcast, the hearings are not complete. They haven't been finished at the CPUC. So although they came out with a statement saying it was going to cost a certain amount, you know, flat fee and then a monthly fee, which is incidentally lower for low-income people if they apply for the CARE program. You can make as much as $31,800 a year and apply for a lower fee. But these hearings are not over, so the fees haven't actually been approved, and they're already coming out and saying they're going to be so. But the point is that people who are rejecting smart meters because of the privacy issues are still using wireless internet connections in their houses. They're using Wi-Fi.
Well, that's because of a massive disconnect, you know.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that they don't realize that both cell phones and wireless internet allow anybody to look and see what you're doing. And surveillance is what's going on now in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter who you are. They're surveilling everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's also something that comes up. People are constantly saying, oh, there's no science. That's nonsense. There's no, of course, there's tons of science, as we've said, and much of it has been suppressed. But science continues to come out. It's just not covered in the conventional media.
Well, but, anyone who says that is just not doing their homework, Lena.
Well, but it's the predominant view. So here are a couple of recent things that just came out that are really worth mentioning. There's a paper by Andrew Goldsworthy on autism and EMF. This is, again, discussing the low-level exposures. Mm-hmm. His paper is titled How Electromagnetically Induced Cell Leakage May Cause Autism. Mm-hmm. Andrew Goldsworthy is an honorary lecturer in biology at the Imperial College in London, and he speaks specifically about something you were mentioning, which is the ion and calcium channels in the body, and how when they're interrupted, it creates neuronal hyperactivity, mm-hmm. and this is causes ADD and HD, all of this and all of these autism spectrums. He says that modulated radio frequency electromagnetic radiation that is far too weak to cause significant heating can nevertheless remove calcium ions, positively charged calcium atoms, from cell membranes in the brain. Mm-hmm. Weak magnetic fields, electromagnetic, can have a greater effect on than strong ones, and these are also prolonged exposures. Then the cells are maintained in the unstable condition for longer, potentially more damaging than a brief exposure, like people using a hairdryer, God forbid. And the loss of calcium is important because calcium ions bind to and stabilize the negatively charged membranes in living tissues.
Right.
Loss of just some of these calcium ions destabilize the membrane, make it more inclined to leak. So the blood-brain barrier leakages, 4 studies show that. Mm-hmm. And they have serious metabolic consequences. I've noticed lots of very overweight people using lots of these technologies and a lot of membrane leakage in the neurons in the brain. Mm-hmm. It also creates a sort of hair trigger so that there's a interruption. There's too many neurotransmitters, and the brain becomes extremely hyperactive, and people become very hyper aroused and panicked. Of course, this is causing a lot more for children. This is causing this pruning process in the brain is causing children to have a defective hardwired mindset for social interactions, which contributes to the various spectrum, mm-hmm. autistic spectrum, mm-hmm. problems. And
much of that could be happening prenatally,
with
exposures through,
oh, yes.
through the mother. That ties in with the recent report from the CDC that found sharp increases in autism. 1 in 88 children now are diagnosed with autism, and the full discussion about whether that was just better diagnosis or whether it was the inclusion of milder forms of autism, such as Asperger's syndrome, in the numbers, and what they determined is that that did not account for the rise. Also, there was a study that found increased incidence in twins, and if you think about it, of course, twins and siblings would be raised in the same environment, both in utero and in the home. So that would follow that it would be a common environmental exposure that would trigger that. But yes, Goldsworthy's piece on autism was directly tied into what I was talking about, having to do with
the calcium
efflux response and how that has the ability to affect any number of outcomes, including autism.
This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We have B. Blake Levitt on the phone today. We're discussing the health considerations for this digital revolution we find ourselves in. Just a couple of other quick sightings. Another brand new paper on occupational EMF exposure and cancers in young workers. This was done at the Hebrew University School of Medicine in Israel. What they're finding is this may explain what I'm seeing, which is very young people with cancers that are extremely aggressive, and the latency period is very fast. They're getting sick very fast, and it's very aggressive, and they're dying And I've never seen that before.
I've had many healthcare provider friends say the exact same thing, that they're seeing younger and younger people with various kinds of disease states that have come on quite quickly that would not be diseases that would come on until they were.
Well, and cancers as well. And lastly, a Greek study shows regions of the brain related to learning, memory, and Alzheimer's are impacted by EMF. This came out very recently.
Well, an early Alzheimer's onset is one of the things that's increasingly being observed too.
So,
again, it ties in with what Richter's work was doing.
Yeah, I won't discuss the mechanisms. I had some stuff highlighted, but I don't want to take the time. Let's just suffice to say that it's nasty business, and there's lots of research, and there's a lot more radiation and electrosmog, and there's...
Well, actually, can I say something about
Please.
This Greek study? Because this
Please.
Was fascinating. What they did was they found learning, memory, other functions of the mammalian brain. They had an animal test models were severely impacted by microwave radiation, and the areas of the brain that they found involved the hippocampus, the cerebellum, and the frontal lobe. They found a total of 143 proteins in the brain that were impacted by RF radiation over a period of 8 months. Now, no other research that I'm aware of had ever done an exposure quite like this, which was for the period of, I think it was three hours a day for 8 months for their test animals, mm-hmm. and then they did a complete examination of the entire biology of the animal. And this was the first time that they had done that kind of a blanket exposure and then a complete analysis of the entire genome of the animal. And this is what they came up with. 143 proteins altered in the brain is nothing
yes.
to sneeze at. That's a big
yes.
deal.
Yes. Yes, it is. So I want to take a moment to look at this from another standpoint. Obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but it is the case that there are many municipalities and states and places, and we could go down the list, but who are resisting. I mean, there's lawsuits in Illinois, Naperville, Illinois, bills in Vermont, citizens are resisting in California. Kauai in Hawaii has just done an injunction to stop the smart meters.
Maine is in court, Connecticut,
all of them. Okay, so what I'd like to do for a moment is to turn to Dr. Fawcett, Jeffrey, to talk about this a little bit from a political standpoint, because what we've had so far is just people fighting with the government and fighting with their PUCs, and we've gotten to the point where we have these little opt-outs, but as we've said, this has been going on for almost 3 years, and we're not getting very far. And there is an issue here now about the fact that people are becoming disabled and losing their homes. So I would like, Jeffrey, if you could say just a few things about the political implications and what might need to happen next.
A good deal of activity, that the bulk of activity around this issue has been around public education, revealing science to people, enabling people to understand what is going on, and resisting mostly local and state implementations of these technologies. And that's where the politics has done. So we have things like, I was just having a conversation with some people about this, trying to think of a good Saul Alinsky kind of politics, and had forgotten at the time that Joshua Hart, who has been very active in Santa Cruz County, has done a lot of kind of direct action things that get media attention. But the hole in the political activity, because there's a lot of really smart people involved in this issue, but the hole in the issue is that the focus of political attention has been on technologies, but it hasn't been on people. People have shown up to combat smart meters and cell towers and those sorts of things, but there's been no real focus on, I call it, I'm electrosensitive, I have rights, don't mess with me. And it is when that kind of political activity, when people stand up and get counted as I'm electrosensitive and I have rights and you are trampling on them, that really needs some attention. I believe that everyone is kind of many of the call it major thought people and media are actually quite frightened. Again, it's in the course of an evening with some people who are involved with this issue, was described how this one woman made a profound impression on a U.S. senator's office about the importance of this issue, and they promised to see what they could do about introducing legislation at a national level, and came back to them and said, "There's no traction here. We can't. We are still in the mode of we are the people with the tinfoil hats." And working in my little community here with a man who has a good deal of experience in marketing, so the key thing here is you have to control the message. And right now, electrosensitives don't control the message. Now, I don't have the answer to this, but the message that needs to be pounded on is that we're electrosensitive, we have rights. So there are a lot of things in motion to advance that, but the tide or the current that we are swimming against is the popular view is there's no science, you're crazy, you wear tinfoil hats. And the
tinfoil doesn't breathe.
Tinfoil doesn't, yes, not breathe.
Can I jump in here?
Well, yeah, let him just finish.
Well, I'm just going to, you know, wrap it up. So I do not have answers
yet,
but I'm working on it. That organizationally, there needs to be that focus of attention on the rights of.
Yeah, we need an organization that protects the rights of disabled people from this technology. Yeah.
Nothing is stopping anyone from forming those kinds of organizations, and it's a question of putting together a national coalition so that people who are electrically sensitive can speak with one voice, speak truth to power. I think that in league with that, I think that as far as moving public policy along, that these recommendations that are coming out of physicians groups in particular may have more power in moving the dialogue quicker. It's not just going to be pressure from activists who have an immediate health stake in this, like people with electrical sensitivity. One of the things that also came out recently, March 23rd, from Switzerland, was from the Physicians for Environment, requests very strict application of the precautionary principle. This is a group of physicians in Europe. They, along with the environmental docs in the U.S. and with the Irish docs in Ireland and with the European Union, I have been saying, as somebody who's been tracking this subject for going on 25, 30 years now, that none of this was really going to change until the clinical practices got involved. And so now what's happening is that whether people with EHS show up in legislative offices or whether they consistently are increasingly showing up in their physicians' offices, somehow that message is getting backtracked. It's getting backtracked through legislation that says we need research, we need protection, we need to understand this better, we need RF-free zones where people can heal. All of that is beginning to come together, but it has to be an alliance between the electrically hypersensitive and the physician communities, because that's who's going to be listened to. That's the only thing that's going to break through the you're all wearing tinfoil hat wearing crazies. That's the thing that's going to break through. That is the physician communities that step up and say we're seeing an awful lot of these people and they're not all crazy. And the other thing that you need to keep in mind is that EHS, electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome, is something that's being reported globally now. And it's not at all likely that everyone on the planet is having the same massive hallucination and identical symptoms. I mean, it's just not likely that that's going on out there. So we've got something happening here that's affecting people's immune systems at the most fundamental level that then does not allow them to walk the planet in its modern capacity. Mm-hmm. And so then what then must we do? And there are several things that we must do. You know, there have to be RF free zones. The way Sweden has mandated, they consider EHS a functional disability in Sweden, and there are parks and beaches where wireless technologies are not allowed, so that people with EHS can participate in civic life. That's the kind of thing that we need to bring to the table in America, mm-hmm. through our physician organizations and through activist groups and through the legislature. But one of the big things that we really need to do is fund an independent research organization that can actually begin to start to pay attention to what it is that we're doing to the planet. If there's a wealthy listener out there who would love to put together a research foundation, I would gladly be the director of that.
I'll give out your contact information so Jeffrey can comment.
Okay, I would love to help somebody put together a foundation that would finally bring together the environmental energy issues with the biology.
Blake, give out your contact information so Jeffrey can comment.
www.blakelevitt.com.
Okay, Jeffrey.
I totally agree that having physician groups identify this condition is politically extremely important. So it would be important for organizations to actively work with them and solicit support. The reason is that having physicians with you gives politicians and administrators cover. One of the problems is you step out and say, I'm concerned about this thing, and it's, oh, God, another guy with the tinfoil hats. Having physicians to give you cover that this is a serious public health issue is extremely important, and even beyond that, other coalition partners, disability community, environmental community, who seems to be totally deaf to this issue.
Oh, God, they're using all of this technology,
But other communities as well that provide political cover for moving our rights forward.
Yeah, I lastly, what I'd say is that it's very difficult for people now, and as someone who has done a lot of research into what other areas there might be to live in, I am very quickly finding that this is proliferated everywhere. But I don't think that it's over, because I do think that there's a precedent for groups of people who need to be accommodated getting that. I mean, the independence movement of disabled people is a good example. So I do think we have to continue to push back, because in my observation, and Blake, in your observation, and Jeffrey's observation, and many other people we know who are very smart, people are getting sicker and sicker and sicker and not knowing why. So it's terribly critical.
Mm-hmm.
So, Blake, I want to thank you so much for... I know you've got probably one last comment, but before we wrap it up, anything last?
Well, my last comment is going to be a sort of a global observation, and that's that if we don't do something about this, then the only thing that we face is either the human race and all other living species. We're either going to evolve with these exposures, or we're simply not.
Right. Yeah, and it's
really that simple.
Right. Yeah, and evolution to these things may not be pretty too. So.
I mean, never know where evolution is going.
Well, but we know from ionizing radiation that they're horrifying, like the shrimps that they're finding now in the Gulf because of the BP spill with no eyes, mm-hmm. and other things like that. I mean, they're not going to be able to survive. Anyway, it's pretty grim.
Non-ionizing radiation is not quite like that, Lena. In my experience and research over the years, it's a little more like Chinese water torture. It's not that obvious.
So you have mass insanity and suicides instead.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good then.
Well, something.
Well, I got to wrap it up, darling.
All right.
Be Blake Levitt, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our 500 archive shows. Choose a download or a library card. Also, find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show on our website, our book and lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or contact us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.